Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground, started to burn many things we found.
Yeah, we did. Oh, we started to burn too many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the crew in New York. And we're going to be joined today by Paul Kangas for a full hour. Paul Kangas is one of the most interesting people I've met in a long, long time. We've known each other quite a while. He is an expert on renewable energy, on the Kennedy assassination, and has just taken a full trip on the legendary Trans-Siberian Railroad. I don't want to talk to him about that. Paul, is that you taking all that noise up there?
I am, my man. Right now I'm printing off a flyer, getting ready to a meeting.
Going to a meeting, but we need your full attention for the next hour. What meeting are you going to? You are in the Bay Area in Northern California, the San Francisco Bay Area. You're one of the primary solar activists up there. And you and I have done a lot of tremendous work to spread the word about solar energy. So tell us, Paul, first of all, give us a bit of your background, which I find fascinating. And then tell us how we're going to make California a total solartopian state.
Well, I have a degree in biology and a degree from Hastings Law School, and I just went to medical school, so I spent a lot of time as a student. But in the 50s, my father told me one day, he says, you know, someday we're going to harness the sun, but first the corporations are going to do it, and then we'll have to take it away from them. And that seems to be what's going on in San Francisco right now. My father built a solar-powered house in Chicago for the Chicago's World's Fair. It was not supposed to be a solar house. It was supposed to just be a glass house. But it turned out to be the first demonstration of solar power.
What year was this?
The World's Fair, there's a book about it called Building the Dream. That's how I found out about it. Somebody showed me the book, and I'd heard about the building of the glass house from my father. I was born in Chicago. And so I wrote a book once upon a time called The Earth Belongs to the People, which we sold about 300,000 copies back in the 60s and 70s. And so I've been doing this stuff a long time. I have a degree in biology from San Francisco.
Paul, the solar house that your father built for the Chicago World's Fair, what year was that?
Good question. It was the 1930s. Somewhere in my library I have the book, but
okay.
I wasn't.
I guess
the Chicago World's Fair. I think it was 1938.
Six. 36 or 38 is what I think it was. Now, this solar house that your father built, was it totally self-sufficient for heating, cooling, and electricity?
No. This was just the engineer, the architect was told, build some unique house. My father was in the Carpenters Union there in Chicago, and so the union built the house for this architect, and it was just a glass house. It was just all glass. And so it turned out when they were building it, it was extremely hot inside in November and December. And in Chicago, that's cold. And they had to take off their shirts to work because it was, and so the engineer realized he had built something unique.
That is unique. And what happened to it? Was it taken down? Is it still intact? Where is this solar house?
Oh, no, there are hundreds of those houses. After the World's Fair, The architect became famous. He built those all over Illinois and Indiana. He built, there are many of them still existing. Your listeners, there are probably people listening right now who live in these glass houses built by this architect that was first built at the World's Fair.
Well, I hope they don't throw stones. And so, Paul Kangas, now you have become a solar enthusiast and activist in California, and you're advocating. Well, tell us what you advocate, please.
Well, okay, one other important thing you need to know about me is I read a book once called The Solar Economy by Hermann Scheer, S-C-H-E-E-R. And that was what really gelled my mind. I had all these ideas about how you could do it, but I didn't see anybody doing it because I was too focused in America. And then this guy, Hermann Scheer, who built a solar-powered house in the Black Forest in 1980 in Germany, and he was living in it and trying to teach people about the value of building solar houses. And everybody was telling him, it's too little, it's too late. And then when Chernobyl melted down, he went around speaking, saying, look, we can build thousands of these houses like I live in. And we will generate enough electricity in Germany from the sun to ban fracking and shut down all the nukes. And when he said that, that got students interested. I was in Germany, Dortmund, just after the meltdown in Chernobyl. And I went to the campuses and I was listening to the debates. And it was really hot and heavy there because people were scared of the radiation coming from Russia, Chernobyl in the Ukraine. And people forget that Ukraine is part of Russia. He convinced people that you could do this, that you could build 100-panel solar houses, even in cloudy Germany, generate enough solar energy that you could shut down all the nukes. And he went to the parliament and said, you can do this. And the parliament said, yes, let's do it. So they passed a law requiring the utilities in Germany to pay 99 cents a kilowatt hour for harvesting solar energy and feeding it onto the grid. And people said, this is too much money, too much money. We won't pay that much. Well, a poll was done in Germany, and at one of these on-the-street TV guys went out and asked people, what do you think about paying a dollar a month more to those people who have 100-panel solar-powered houses? Pay them to generate solar energy, to feed it onto the grid so Germany can go solar and wind. And this one guy gave the perfect answer. He said, you know, I spend, that would be about $20 a year, 20 euros a year for solar electricity. Well, I spend 20 euros a month on beer. Why would I be afraid to pay $20 a year if we can shut down the nukes? And so the parliament passed this law. Now, you're right on time, Harvey. Here's what the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle says today. Poll, Americans favor higher bills to pay the electrical companies to stop global warming. And the statistics are like this. 57% of Americans in the poll would favor paying a dollar a month more to the electric companies to pay those who sell solar onto the grid. 39% favor raising our electric bill $10 a month. This is a lot more than the Germans are charging. But 39% of the Americans in the poll favored $10 a month. And 33% favored paying $20 a month more to the electric companies if we can fund 100-panel solar-powered houses so we can ban fracking and shut down all the nukes across the country. That's what is in the South today.
You're advocating, you've been advocating as long as I've known you, the idea of 100 solar panels on a house. What's the magic of 100 panels?
That's a good question. As a matter of fact, I get asked that question once a week on the street. What's the magic number? Why 100? And I say, because if you have 100 panels, you can generate the magic word surplus. and all of a sudden, a 100-panel solar-powered house generates 400% more energy than they need. So you now shut down the oil companies, you shut down the nukes, you shut down the coal companies, and you can shut down the gas companies. And that's exactly what just happened in Germany. Last year, Germany banned all fracking in Germany. I was in Germany two summers ago, and I lived in one of these 100-panel solar houses. And I went and interviewed probably 60 people on the streets. I made a film about it. And one of the people I interviewed was the governor of Baden State. And I saw the governor, and I walked up to him, and I asked his security if I could interview him. I asked him, does this governor speak English? And the security guard just shrugged his shoulders and said, ask him. So I went over and asked the governor, Herr Kirchner of Baden, is it true that Germany is on track for shutting down all the nukes in Germany and replacing it with solar and wind? And he said, most assuredly, that's exactly what we're doing. We're doing it on schedule. We're going to do it by May 1st, 2022. You can see that interview on my YouTube, which is at my name, Paul 8, the number 8, the figure 8, Kangas, on YouTube. And you'll see the interview with the governor of Baden State.
Well, Paul Kangas, you spent quite a bit of time in Germany, and you're a major student and advocate of what the energy being, the energy transition that's going on in Germany. So describe to us what is actually going on in Germany and whether it's successful.
Well, Germany is quite amazing when you go there. I recommend people go to the town of Freiburg, and you will see thousands of these 100-panel solar houses. And but first take a look at a map of Germany, and you'll notice all over northern Germany, there's huge windmills, 70, 80, 100 feet high windmills, giant windmills with propellers on them the size of a 747. They're generating massive amounts of centralized clean energy. We do not necessarily want centralized clean energy. What we want is we want to shift the power struggle structure towards giving the families more energy, more power, more money, and more political power. And so the corporations are going for big windmills in Germany. Northern Germany is like this. Northern Germany's got a lot of wind power, which powers their grid 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then the solar kicks in from southern Germany in the daytime. So very soon, they're going to be at 100% solar and wind power for the whole state of Germany. They already achieve it every year, and I think it's June. They achieve about a week or two of 100% solar and wind power for the whole nation of Germany. That's going on today, right now. Germany will probably be the first 100% wind and solar powered nation on Earth. And if people want to read the book about it by the guy who created this policy, read The Solar Economy by Hermann Schieritz. You can get it online for about $5. Great book.
We're hearing from the pro-nuclear forces that the energy being the transition is actually not successful and that it's been resulting in burning more fossil fuels. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. That is a good lie. That's a somewhat truthful lie. What is Germany doing? See, German law requires giving priority to solar and wind. Now, they hate this. It forces them to shut down their coal-fired power plants and their diesel power plants and their nukes. So as you probably know, Germany has shut down most of their nukes by now. I think there's five left. They're going to turn them all off. And it's the money is coming from the public. The public is still 100% behind this. In fact, Angela Merkel was opposed to this policy. She was pro-atomic energy until she watched Fukushima meltdown, and then she said, it's all over. We've got to go solar and wind. It's all over with nukes. And so she pushed the policy. You hear that in the Western press, that it's causing them to spend money on coal, and they're importing oil and gas from Russia, which is one of the reasons I went to Russia this summer. I took the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and if you want an amazing adventure, ride the Trans-Siberian Railroad. It is like riding a train across the United States in the 1850s. The trains are
I want to talk about that with you in a little bit before the end of the show. We're giving you the full hour here, Paul, because you're such an interesting character. You're like that guy who drinks that whiskey, and they call him the world's most interesting character. So, but let's get back to renewable energy. So, are you saying that the transition in Germany from coal, oil, nukes, and gas, or King Kong, to a solartopian reality is actually succeeding?
It is happening right now. This is the month. The statistics on Germany's wind and solar and biomass generation are probably out on the internet now. You see them every year. And the best conference in the world happens in San Francisco July of every year. It's called InterSolar, which people from all over the world come to San Francisco and speak about all these changes that are happening. But it is happening in Germany right now. And Germany is – here's the lie that they publish about Germany. They say, oh, it's slowing down. What they're meaning is this. The law in Germany says that as the price of solar panels falls, we will lower the amount of money paid to solar homes who have panels on their roof. I spent a couple of hours with a farmer out on the edge of Freiburg, and he was telling me so excitedly in German, I had a translator with me, that he's making a ton of money. He's making $2,000 a month income from the solar panels on his barns and his chicken coop and his house and his fields, and that this is a legacy he's leaving his children. Because the panels will last 100 years or more. The transition is happening now in Germany, and it is shocking that they're doing it. And one of the things Germany did to spread the transition was when a Chinese official came to Germany and asked to buy one of these solar manufacturing plants, the German government sold the plants to the Chinese. The Chinese then went back and made copies of this factory for manufacturing solar, and then China discovered massive amounts of silicon in China, and so China has now manufactured more solar panels than all the rest of the countries in the whole world combined. It is shocking what I saw in China going on last summer. It's happening in Germany first, and right now the competition is, you have to remember, but the key word here is decentralization. The media only talks about corporations building solar farms and corporations building windmills. They don't talk about the fact that in Germany, the working class is now getting close to controlling political power in Germany because they own 100-panel solar houses. This is the most. This creates local jobs that cannot be offshored. This puts political power in the hands of the working class of Germany. The solar revolution, Solartopia, is going to be Germany by the year 2022. And it is coming fast. So I'm going to Germany for May 1st, 2022, to watch the last nuke shut down. It's going to be
beautiful. There's going to be a big party in Germany for that, like when the Berlin Wall
yes.
came down. I'm going to predict that last nuke was shut early, actually. I bet it goes down ahead of schedule.
Yes, you are.
So how do you propose to make the energy transition from King Kong to Solartopia that's happening in Germany? How do you propose to translate that to California?
It's happening in California very rapidly. We have a guy running for the state senate right now in San Francisco, who just passed a law in San Francisco just a month or so ago that requires all new construction. All buildings in San Francisco must be solar powered starting January 2017. His name is Scott Wiener, and he's running for the state Senate. I hope he gets elected because this was only the second city in the United States to pass such a law. And this is
What other city passed such a law?
Lancaster, California. The mayor, Rex Paris, this solar revolutionary, Rex Paris, passed it down there, even though a lot of rich people threatened him, saying, if you try to pass that, we'll run somebody against you. He said, I dare you. Watch what happens. He did it. They ran somebody against him. He won by 3-1 against the opposition.
So you're saying that the law in Lancaster and now in San Francisco says you got to build solar on a new building. Does that mean the building has to be 100% solar? What are the specs on the solarization of the building?
Yes, in Lancaster the law says 100% solar. In San Francisco,
it doesn't. That means 100% electricity and 100% heating and cooling. I have all. Everything in the house has to be powered by solar.
Yes. But then California just this year passed a law that is very similar to the German law, passed a law in California that said utilities in California now must pay 15 cents a kilowatt hour to anybody in California feeding solar onto the grid. And a friend of yours and mine has an apartment in San Francisco here that has 100 solar panels on the roof. And so I'm trying to get the paperwork from him to show how much PG&E is paying. But more importantly, the state of Maine has passed the same law. The PUC in Maine requires utilities to pay 33 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, that's half of what you need, but it's a good start. So we are petitioning the California PUC to raise it to 49 cents a kilowatt hour as a token towards the 49ers who started the gold rush in California. We want to start a gold rush of building houses, solar houses in California.
Okay, so you are dealing with the town of Alameda to do solar development there. Tell me about that.
That's one of the seven projects we're doing. Yes, Alameda is its own utility. So Alameda can easily adopt what California has now adopted, both on requiring the utility, its own city utility, to pay solar homeowners in Alameda. And they just put the naval base where I was stationed in 1960. I was in the Navy there. They put it up for lease. They've leased hundreds of acres of land right in the middle of the San Francisco Bay to build houses and businesses. So I'm in the process of building a solar-powered business there, which will be a 100-panel solar-powered mall. Some of the buildings will be residential, and half of them will be commercial. It'll be, if I can pull this off, it'll be the first 100-panel solar-powered house in Alameda. I've got seven other projects like this going on throughout California. You may have heard of the massive fire we had in Lake County last year and last month. You know, thousands of people lost their homes in Lake County. One of the most famous places that burned was Harbin Hot Springs, a famous hippie hot springs from the 1960s, where the Grateful Dead used to live on weekends. And so I've proposed to them that one of the buildings they replace, because the nice thing about them is they had insurance, so they have the money to rebuild. They are rebuilding as we speak. And I'm talking to them about building one of the buildings being a 100-panel solar-powered A-frame fourplex house, so that there's four units there, and that's a roof big enough for 100 panels. And the house I'm living in San Francisco right now, the owner wants to install 50 solar panels on. So I've got a lot
of
these
solar projects. Where are these solar panels coming from?
Oh, that's a good question, but that's politically charged issue. I urge people to buy their solar panels from China as a way to make peace with the Chinese and to go against what all the politicians are saying. Is they're saying, oh, the Chinese are stealing our jobs. The Chinese are not stealing our jobs. They build the highest quality solar panels in the world, and I'm encouraging people to buy from China. You can buy from American if you want to. It doesn't matter to me, but I'm not afraid to say buy solar panels from China because there's a blockade against it, and the blockade is illegal. And Obama put that blockade in place, and it's got to be broken. The Chinese want to trade with us. We should trade with the Chinese. We need to have peace with the Chinese. See, the building of a 100-panel solar-powered house creates jobs here in America that cannot be offshored. This is local power. And so this, I believe, is the way. That's why I have Chinese solar panels.
Okay, so in Los Angeles, there is a possibility that, of course, that the whole city could become solar pretty quickly. But we're meeting resistance from the Department of Water and Power, which is owned by the public, but which limits the amount, the number of solar panels, or actually the capacity of solar panels that you can put on your house. When I called Solar City to come look and put panels on our house in the valley, the installer said that they could only install solar capacity up to the amount of solar electricity that we used in the house, and therefore would not be eligible to generate more electricity than we use and then force the DWP to buy it. What's that all about?
Well, that's a political fight, and here's how you defeat it. I'm so glad you raised that question and you pointed towards Los Angeles, because a friend of ours, Peter Matthews, is building a 100-panel solar house in Long Beach. And I said, Peter, you know what's going to happen if you do that? They're going to try and tell you you can't do it. And he said, good. Let them see if they can beat my lawyers and me in court on this issue. We will force the issue. That's what I tell everybody. We will force the issue into the courts. And if we go into the courts with the present atmosphere in California, we will win, because we can force the PUC to pay a higher rate. We can force PG&E to accept 100-panel solar houses. All of this is a political fight, and the great way to you got to fight it in the courts too. And the way you do it is you simply build a add a new roof and add 100 panels to your roof, and then watch what happens. You think Peter wants to do it because he's going to run for office in the state of California. And he wants to have a political fight. I told him, you'd be doing what Gandhi did when he organized 100,000 people to march to the sea and gather water from the ocean and then dehydrate it with the sun and harvest salt and sell the salt. This is the same battle that Gandhi fought 100 years ago in India, where he was trying to break the salt tax. We're now trying to break the solar tax by simply doing it and forcing them to try and stop us. They can't stop us. The book, The Solar Economy by Herman Scheer, points this out in every chapter. He says, it is inevitable. You will win every single political struggle you engage in on this issue. You will win every time. And he's right. We can't lose.
All right. Well, we'll see how that goes. We'll talk to you a little bit about more about that, but I do, before we run out of time, want to have you tell us about the Trans-Siberian Railroad. You and a friend of yours a while ago went over somewhere on the other side of the planet and hopped on a train. And before I try and describe it, why don't you tell us exactly what you did? Because I've never talked to anybody who did the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So let's hear all about it.
Well, yeah, my girlfriend and I, we went to law school together. And one day we were talking, and I said, well, this summer I'm going to ride the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Moscow to Beijing. And she's Chinese, and she's an attorney. So we had just started living together, and so she said, wow, I've been trying to find somebody to go to ride the Trans-Siberian Railroad for years, and nobody will go with me. They think it's crazy. So I said, oh, no, it's no problem, because I studied it. And you just go to Finland, where my relatives are from, and you'll notice my last name is spelled Kangas, K-A-N-G-A-S. It turns out that's a Mongolian name. The Mongolians invade. So when we get on the train Moscow.
Where did you go to catch this train? How did you get on?
Well, first,
were you food aware?
It's really difficult because the Russians have these huge rules that you have to hop over. So the first thing you have to do is arrange a hotel room in Moscow. Once you have proof that you have paid for a hotel room in Moscow for a week, then the Russians will issue you a visa. That's the trick. So we did that. And then everything else was easy. Then we went online and got a ticket on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. And
you bought it online?
You order it online.
Did you arrange your hotel room online?
Online, everything we did online. We even arranged to stay in a Mongolian gur, which is basically a very large teepee where they have solar panels on the gurs in Mongolia. There's no grid out in Mongolia. I'll get to that in a minute. But,
all right, so you and your girlfriend, you flew from San Francisco to where?
New York and then Helsinki, Finland.
Okay, and then when you got to Finland, did you get on a train to go to Moscow?
No, then we flew to Moscow from Finland.
You flew from Helsinki. You flew from Helsinki to Moscow.
Yeah, thin air. Yeah.
Okay, and so then you're in Moscow, you go to the hotel. You had to stay in the hotel a week?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you went down to the train station in Moscow, and you walked onto a train.
Yes. It's the Kerensky Station.
Okay, and the train heads towards... Now, did you have a sleeper? Did you have a compartment? What kind of accommodations on this train?
Good question. It's all sleepers. All the seats are actually beds. The one we had was a four-person compartment with four beds. And in the daytime, everybody sits around and talks. It was a great way to meet Russians because the Russians use the Trans-Siberian Railroad the way people use a metro. They travel all over Russia on this train. And so we met hundreds of Russians. And even though many of them didn't speak much English, we had a lot of fun. I carry this picture of a 100-panel solar-powered house with me. And I showed it to people, and it was great icebreaker to get people to using their limited English. English is now the international language. Wherever you go in the world, you will find people who speak English. It was quite easy for us in Moscow, even down on the metro. If I needed somebody that spoke English, I just looked around to see who was wearing a white shirt. And it was usually these students wearing a white shirt, and I'd go over and ask them, do you speak English? And they'd say, oh, sure, because a large percentage of the young people speak English now. And so we didn't get on.
You're in a compartment that has four beds, and you and your girlfriend had two of them, and then the other two were open to other people. Is that right?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, about every 6 hours or so, you would get a different set of companions in your compartment.
Wow. And this went on for a month?
Yeah.
How many days were you on this train?
Well, we stayed on the train constantly until we got to the world's largest freshwater lake, Lake Baikal, which is fed by a giant glacier in eastern Mongolia. And this is a lake that freezes over about 4 months of the year. And we were there for a week at this lake, and then we went to a city called Irkutsk, and we wandered around Irkutsk for a week.
So you can get on and off the train? You don't have to stay on the train with your ticket?
You do not have to stay on the train. The only problem is the train's full a lot of the time, so you can come to the station and not get on the train. So you have to be aware of that, that there's a danger that when you're...
Uh-huh.
You get
Did
on,
that happen?
You come to,
happened,
yeah.
It happened to you a couple times? You went down to the station and they didn't have any room?
No, we were incredibly lucky in the whole trip. Let me tell you, we were incredibly lucky. Even when we got to Mongolia and there was no seat on the bus, we got off the train at one point because the train would have taken too long to get to Beijing and we would have missed our flight out of Beijing back to San Francisco. So we got on a bus in Mongolia. And when we get to the bus station at 5 o'clock in the morning, all the seats are sold. And my girlfriend's Chinese. And so I get into a conversation. I brought a solar panel with me, too. And I got into a conversation with this Mongolian guy who lived in the capital about solar panels. And he was so interested in what I was saying that he invited my girlfriend and I to come and stay with him and his family in the capital of Mongolia for a couple of days. So somehow my girlfriend convinced the owner of the bus to let us be on the bus even though there was no seats for sale. They sold us tickets anyhow. And so we got really lucky. And so we traveled to the capital and we stayed with this Mongolian family in Mongolia.
How did you travel with a solar panel? How big is the solar panel?
Oh, there's a company called Goal Zero, Z-E-R-O, that makes a solar panel that has a crank on it. It is a flashlight, and it's not very big. It's like almost a foot long and 3 inches wide. And what I have it right here in my hand now. It's about twice as big as a cell phone. And it allows you, it has a crank on it, so it gives you power either from the sun or from cranking it. So I used it to power my cell phone and my iPad all around the world, wherever I went. But it was a great conversational piece, too, for breaking the ice and getting people interested in science and using their English. And without it, it would have been harder to talk to people. But it was my opening gambit wherever I went, the picture of the 100-panel uh-huh. solar house and this solar panel I was carrying.
Let me ask you about that. While you were on the train, did you eat on the... You must have ate on the train every day, right?
Oh, let me tell you, that's a whole story. They have a 4-page menu, and you can order, beefsteak or prawns or sushi, anything you want off the menu, but you will only get one thing delivered to your table. Borscht.
Yes. So you ate borscht for a month while you were on the train?
Yeah. No, we were only on the train for maybe 7 or 8 days because we kept getting off different places like Moscow. Well, we were in Moscow and then we were in Irkutsk, and so we were in different places. But yeah,
there's
a dining car on the train. The best thing about the train is this. There's a giant hot water heater on each car. And people bring their own food and make their own tea and their own dried noodles. They don't eat in the dining car. The dining car is for people that don't know how to cook. But we ate in the dining car simply because we wanted to meet more people. And the whole trip I videotaped, and 5 minutes each day. And you see it on my YouTube site. Just go in to my YouTube site, Paul 8, the number 8, Kangas, and then put in the words. The code word is Kangas in Russia. And you will see, it'll take you right to my 30 videos that I put up on YouTube. The whole trip.
So if you wanted to ride the train straight from Moscow to Beijing, how long would that take you?
That would take you about a day longer than a month. So it would take you slightly more than a month. If you wanted to ride it straight, let me see, 7 or 8 days it would take you riding straight to Beijing.
24 hours a day. And
yeah.
So what you did
you don't
was
want
you
to
got
do
off.
That.
you got off from place to place. How much does a ticket cost between Beijing and Moscow in U.S. dollars?
Ooh, I would guess $1,000. I don't remember because we had problems there because when we got to Moscow and went to get our ticket that we had paid for, they had no record of us ordering a ticket, even though we had receipts showing we had purchased one online.
So what did you do?
So we had to pay, and fortunately, my American Express credit card worked in Moscow, and it worked in Mongolia, and it worked in Beijing.
Wow.
Other credit cards may not work.
So do you have to pay second time for your ticket?
Yeah.
Wow.
But that's okay, because I just went to the company that sold it to us, and I'm still negotiating with them to get my money back.
Good luck. So the trip you took, you spent a full month. How much of it in China and how much of it in Russia?
It was about one-third in Russia, one-third in Mongolia, one-third in China.
Did you talk to people in China also about solar energy?
Oh, yeah. I had a meeting with the head of the vice president of Alibaba. I had a meeting with the president of a company called Hanergy, H-A-N-E-R-G-Y. They are the world's leader of manufacturing thin-film solar panels. They are manufacturing a solar-powered car. There are 200 companies like Tesla in China manufacturing electric cars. 200 companies just like Tesla.
My God. How are the cars? Yeah. Did you see their cars?
Yeah. They look fine. They're just electric cars. In fact, there's a law in China today, when we were there, that if your car is gas-powered, you can only be on the road every other day, depending on your license number. Whereas with electric cars, they're allowed to be on the road 7 days a week in China. The Chinese government has just ordered a reduction of the number of electric car companies in China. They have ordered them to consolidate. They've told them, you know, we're not going to allow this many companies producing electric cars. We only want the 10 best companies, so we want you other companies to move in and consolidate with other people. And they're doing it. Anyhow, what was your next question?
Well, did you see any cars in China that compared to the Tesla?
Yes. Yeah, there were electric cars that compared to Tesla.
Wow. But car ownership is nowhere near as widespread in China as it is in the United States, is it?
But right now, today, in China, there are 300,000 electric cars on the road in China. The major companies are a company called BYD, which spells Build Your Dream. This company also has a branch office in Lancaster, California, where they manufacture electric buses that go from Lancaster to Los Angeles and back and forth every day, electric buses. And the other company in China was Chery, C-H-E-R-R-Y. And then there's a bunch of them. There's a lot of them.
So did you on your train ride? You must have stopped in China before you got to Beijing.
Yeah.
And where did you stop?
Well, let me tell you about Mongolia. Mongolia blew our minds. We never expected to see the advances, the scientific advances that are going on in Mongolia. It was amazing. Everybody in Mongolia has a cell phone. And an awful lot of Mongolians to this day are still nomads who live. We stayed for a week in Gurs, on a horse ranch, where I was out in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, riding horses with the Mongolians, cowboys, chasing down wild horses and capturing them. And then I come back in the evening and I was milking the goats, where we lived on goat milk and goat cheese and goat yogurt. Because I'm from the farm. I was raised on a farm most of my life, on a horse ranch in Oregon. So I'm familiar with riding horses and roping and things like that. So I was cowboying out in Mongolia. And the thing that was most impressive that I took pictures of, and you'll see it on the YouTube site, is gurs, these giant teepees that people live in with solar panels and windmills on them. That's right. Windmills and solar panels on teepees, basically. And, oh, I forgot. In Lake Baikal in Russia, I found ships with solar panels and windmills on the ships in Russia. And this German company, Siemens, is building a huge amount, tens of thousands of windmills out in the Siberian steppe in Russia. So there's a lot of advances going on in Russia in wind. And when we entered China, when we crossed the border, the Great Wall, into China, all of a sudden, you start seeing more and more windmills. It was phenomenal. I personally counted about 8,000 or 9,000 windmills that I saw in northern China. Massive numbers of windmills. These are huge. The propeller on it is as big as a 747.
Who owns these windmills?
The state of China.
Uh-huh.
Xi Jinping. And see, that's the difference between America and China, is that over there, the state owns all this stuff. And so if the state passes a law that says the utility, which is a state utility, must pay the solar homeowners for the energy fed onto the grid, that gives the Chinese government tremendous flexibility. For that reason, I expect to see China surpass the United States easily in solar and wind in the next 5 years. I mean, they issued their five-year plan saying they're going to do this in the next 5 years. They're simply going to do it because they have the flexibility and they have the control and they have the power to do this, to become a solar-powered nation. When I was in, everybody was telling me, oh, the air pollution's terrible in China. Not true. I took all kinds of videos in downtown Beijing, and I specifically aimed them into the skyline so you could see the air, how clean it is. But I also, in the process of talking to people there, discovered why it was that way. It's because the bad air pollution doesn't happen except in December and January for some reason because of the weather conditions. But China is moving very rapidly. I mean, they are a centralized government that does not have to listen to private homeowners going to court and stopping them from doing what they want to do. The Chinese government does what it wants to do. If they want to have a bullet line that goes from Beijing to Moscow, they're just going to draw a line from Beijing to Moscow, and they're going to build a bullet line, and they're doing that.
How long will it take to get from Beijing to Moscow on the bullet line?
Well, right now, the whole Soviet train system is electrical. This is a huge advantage. You know, can you imagine if the whole United States train system was electric-powered diesels, electric-powered engines? How much easier it would be to go to solar panels, like Germany has, their whole train system is electrical. So all they do is put solar panels along the right-of-way for the trains, and they're feeding solar energy onto the whole train system. Russia can do that quite easily, but what they're doing is they're putting windmills along the Trans-Siberia Railroad. So they're going to be powering the whole rail system in the next 5 years with windmills. So that's something that people should look forward to and try and find the news on. And with China, they're going even faster and further. They are building bullet trains. We went to the Museum of Trains in Beijing, right next to Red Square. Oh, I had an interesting international incident happen when I was in Red Square. I was taking pictures with my camera, and I was taking pictures of a couple police officers. And one of the officers for some reason took offense that I was taking pictures of them. He came over, looked at my camera and my cell phone, and he hit delete. He deleted the picture I took of them, which they can do over there. Anyhow, we went to the train museum, and in the basement of the train museum, there is a giant, the whole basement is a giant map of China, you know, with trains, real life trains and three-dimensional trains being shown running all over these tracks all over China. And they're showing, they're projecting where they're going next, with which line next. So right now, as we speak, there is a train leaving Beijing going to Moscow. And there's a train leaving Moscow going to Beijing.
Okay.
There's tremendous amount of trade and diplomatic agreements and things going on between China and Russia. Those two countries are actually one country at this point in history because of the trade that goes on between them.
What is happening in China with nuclear power? Are they building more? Oh. Are they abandoning it? And nobody can figure out what direction they're heading with nuclear power in China.
Okay, I'm glad you asked me because I read China Daily.
And we have, Paul, we have just 4 minutes, so you're going to have to speak really quickly.
Okay. China is pushing for more solar power, but they have just said in a recent five-year plan that they're now going to push much harder for solar, and they're going to cut back on coal-fired power plants, and they're not going to be building many more atomic energy plants. They are as afraid of atomic energy as the Japanese are, but they're caught in a situation where they feel they have to do it in order to satisfy the working class's demands for energy. So they scientifically, the Central Committee, I think, is smarter than the American Congress. And so I wish we could get some smart people in this country who know science into the Congress. China.
Are you saying that the Chinese are going to build more nuclear plants as well?
Yes. More solar, and they're in a dual race. They're telling the solar people, go further, go faster. They're telling the nuclear people, go further, go faster, and see who's going to win this race. I don't like it. It's terrible, but I think solar's going to win the race. And these are pragmatic people, but they're also scientific people who I think are going to do it. I'll give you an example of the cooperation between these countries. That's one of the things I went there to find out about, is the unity between the Russians and the Chinese.
Okay, Paul. Okay, right. Paul Kangas, listen, hey Paul, I actually we're not going to be able to get into that. We only have 2 minutes left. Tell us in 1 minute what's going to happen in California now with solar energy.
We are moving very rapidly because we have this PUC ruling that says the utilities must pay 15 cents. We are petitioning the PUC to try and raise it to 49 cents. But since San Francisco has passed this law now requiring all new construction be solar, I think California is going to be doing okay, but not as good as China, not as good as Germany. I wish I could give you better news for California.
All right, well, listen, I'm moving to L.A. You're in San Francisco. We'll push California to Solartopia as fast as we possibly can. Good luck with this project in Alameda. And I got to say, you're the only guy I know ever who took the train from Moscow to Beijing, and it's something I think I really want to do in my lifetime. I'm sure a lot of people have added it to their bucket list. And so where do they go to find you, Paul Kangas?
They can find me on you. My email address is David, like David Roger, 8kangas@gmail.
Very good. Thank you so much. A fascinating hour with Paul Kangas. We'll be back next week. Thank you to the crew in New York. We'll see you in Solartopia in another week.
Solartopia, don't you know?